Good day, everyone, and welcome to this 15th presentation of Inside the Beltway by Drinker Biddle. For opening remarks and introductions, I will turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. To everybody but those of you on the East Coast, good morning. And to those of you on the East Coast, good afternoon. The interest in the DOL's fiduciary proposal is phenomenal. We've had almost 1,000 people sign up for this conference call, so I'm very appreciative to Nat Tixis for sponsoring it and to you all for listening in. As the operator mentioned, the call is being recorded. It'll take us a couple days to post it on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com. It'll be under a tab called Resources. But you don't even have to worry about that. Everybody who's registered for the program will receive an email with a link once it's available. So certainly by the middle of next week, you should be able to receiving a link to the recording if you or some of your compatriots want to listen to this call. First let me introduce myself. I'm the partner with Drinker Biddle, and I'm the chair of what's called our Financial Services ERISA team, meaning that we provide ERISA advice and fiduciary advice to companies and businesses that sell services, investments, and products to retirement plans. In other words, financial service companies for what they provide to retirement plans. With me is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. Brad is truly inside the Beltway. While Brad's a great attorney, I think of even more relevance for this program. Brad is the past assistant secretary of the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, meaning that he held Phyllis Borzi's position under the George W. Bush administration. Also with me is Bill Slimbaugh from NatTixis. As you all know, NatTixis sponsors these programs so that we're able to bring this information to you every quarter. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate your support and what you allow us to do. Why don't you take a second and talk to the folks about that?
I will do that. Thank you. And good afternoon from Boston. On behalf of all our NatTixis associates around the globe, thank you for taking the time to join us today. As many of you know, for years, NatTixis has offered through mutual funds, separate accounts, and collective trusts, world-class money managers to help our clients build portfolios and provide the components to help their clients have better long-term investment performance and increase their financial lives. And we do this through names like Luma Sales, Oakmark Funds, Von Nelson, Gateway, and others. In addition to providing world-class money managers, NatTixis has built out what I believe to be the most robust lineup of non-product offerings in the industry to help our best advisor clients improve their clients' financial lives. For those of you familiar with it, our portfolio clarity process is helping our advisor clients to build, test, and strengthen asset allocation portfolios, ultimately delivering long-term performance that's better than what they would do otherwise to their clients. And if you're not familiar with Portfolio Clarity and like more information, please contact your NatTixis partner or go to our website, which is durableportfolios.com. Another non-product offering we're very proud of is our relationship with Drinker Biddle. This is our 10th quarterly call, and it really couldn't be more timely. It seems like everybody, and certainly the media, is singularly focused on those folks battling to get inside the Beltway through this electoral process. And while this is happening, Washington continues to grind, and it continues to work on things that will ultimately change our day-to-day business dramatically. And we're very pleased with our relationship with Drinker Biddle to offer the preeminent experts on this topic. And without further ado, I'll turn it back to Brad and Fred for their comments.
Bill, thank you so much. Those are very kind words, and I really appreciate that. Let's make maximum use of everybody's time and go to the heart of the matter. Brad, as I said earlier, you are literally inside the Beltway. What's the latest word on when the fiduciary rule is coming out?
Well, as is so often the case in Washington, it's really a mishmash of conflicting rumor, innuendo, and speculation. Well, actually, innuendo would be probably more exciting than really we should give credit to this issue. But at any rate, everyone's speculating about that. We know for that the last meeting with the White House, with the Office of Management and Budget, by outside groups, industry groups, is on Friday. I guess tomorrow. So theoretically, the regulation could come out as soon as next week. I think in reality, it'll be closer to the end of the month when Secretary Perez was on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago talking to Democrat members of Congress. He indicated that the rule at that time was about 4 to 8 weeks away from being published, and 4 weeks would be the 21st of March from when he gave that talk. So somewhere, I would say, if I were to guess, and unfortunately that's what we're all doing, most folks are guessing that we're looking by the end of March in all likelihood to see the final rule published. It could, of course, go longer than that. There's no hard and fast rule on this, but I think that's a good operating assumption that most of us are working with.
Brad, just because it comes out doesn't mean people have to comply, does it? When do you think it's actually going to be applicable? In other words, when are people going to have to conduct themselves in a manner consistent with these rules?
Yeah, and this is one of those definitional issues that lawyers love to get wrapped around the axle on and confuse people with. But you have the date something's published. You have the date that it becomes a valid regulation in the sense of good law on the books, so to speak, and then you have the date people actually have to comply. So for our purposes, let's forget about all those intermediate steps and just say, what's the date by which people have to comply? Again, we're speculating, but I think it's a pretty good bet to say that the Obama administration is going to want to have a deadline where we have to actually begin complying of roughly the end of the year. They're going to want to have that deadline in place before they leave. And, of course, President Obama's term ends at noon on January 20th of next year. But if they have that rule that's in place and we have to have complied with it in substantial part, again, I just think the end of the year is a good rule of thumb, then it's going to make it much harder for the next administration to undo what they've done because we'll have all already spent significant amounts of time and treasure on compliance. I always like to use the analogy in you can say whether it's appropriate or not, but I use the analogy of the old low-flush toilets, which we all don't like. They went through all the fight to get those in place. Now people don't like them and would like to go back to the old toilet standard, but it's, among others, the plumbing industry that doesn't want to expend the money to retool and therefore is now protecting a standard they once deposed. I think the Obama administration thinks a similar thing would happen here. If we spent the money to comply and they leave, probably the impetus to significantly change it will go with them.
Yeah, Brad, as a follow-up to that, to the issuance of the rule, in the industry media, there are recurring articles about how legislation is being introduced that will either override the rule or that will delay the effective date or that will defund the enforcement of the rule. What do you make of all that? Is that mostly political posturing, or does it have a real chance?
Well, it is real and substantive, but the chance is not that good. And so what I mean by that is you have some genuine bipartisan legislation in the House by Mr. Roskam and Mr. Neal and also Mr. Rowe. So it's both the Tax Committee and the Labor Committees who are working on legislation as an alternative. There's also other bills out there, the Wagner bill that would make DOL wait until the SEC resolves similar issues. And you also have efforts to do something in the appropriations process, whether it's to call for a delay or to put those bills in an appropriations bill or whatever it might be. And those are all things that Congress is actively working on. The problem with those and with also the Congressional Review Act, which is a process by which Congress can have a negative vote on a finalized regulation within 60 legislative days of it being published, the problem with all of those is they require a presidential signature to go into effect. And we have to assume that President Obama is going to veto anything that undoes one of his signature regulations. And it's unlikely, even though I think bipartisan concern with this regulation is also real and I think will probably grow after we see what's in it in the final rule, it's probably unlikely to be a two-thirds veto-proof majority. So I think congressional interest is high, congressional activity is real. The likelihood, at least in the short term, of Congress being able to stop something, I think, is unfortunately rather low.
And Brad, we also hear that different trade associations or businesses may file lawsuits asserting that the regulation is invalid for one reason or another. What do you think about that?
I think it's a very real possibility that litigation will be filed asking federal courts to block the implementation of this rule on several different grounds. And I think there's some, personally, I think there's some legitimate grounds to go after DOL on this and indicate that they didn't follow that great of a process, that they have done some things that I think they lack the authority to do, that maybe some of their decisions have been arbitrary and capricious in terms of the legal standards that might apply to making regulations. So I think there's some legitimate arguments there. Of course, no one can predict what a court's going to do with them. But I think if we have a final rule that looks a lot like the proposal, and as we'll talk about in a minute, I think in most material respects it will look a lot like the proposal, then we're going to very likely see litigation. Now, as to the prospects of that litigation, how will courts receive it? Well, yeah, no one can really predict where a court's going to go. But now, again, I think there's some real issues to litigate. Will they result in the court stopping the rule from going to effect while it's litigated is really the big question, and we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well, that the lawsuits will not just claim that the regulation was invalid, but if the courts allow it to go into effect before that's determined, which would take a year or two, then the regulation will already be in effect. People will already have spent all kinds of money and effort to comply, and as a result, any victory might be somewhat pyrrhic.
Yeah, essentially they have to demonstrate an irreparable harm standard, among others, to call for the court to act on a temporary basis. Now, I think there are some other legal arguments there, and I'm frankly not the right person to get into how one litigates in a federal regulation. But, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that part of the argument will be – well, another interesting fact for the litigation is there was that report released by the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, which looked at a lot of interaction between DOL and SEC and DOL and Treasury, and there were some very interesting email exchanges they captured and other information that suggests that DOL wasn't listening to its fellow agencies very well. And that effectively has been pre-litigation discovery for the industry. So I think there's some useful information there that we'll see pop up in those lawsuits, assuming they're filed.
Well, let's move on. I mean, that's the 100,000 foot view. Let's at least drop down to maybe 20,000 feet. There are three pieces of the fiduciary package that are of the most interest to advisors, that are the most interest in the distribution of investments and the distribution of services related to investments and plans. Those three pieces are the fiduciary definition, which essentially is saying, when do you become a fiduciary and what are you a fiduciary for? And then there's the 8424 or 84-24 prohibited transaction exemption, which applies to insurance products sold to plans or IRAs. And by the way, this fiduciary definition is going to apply, generally speaking, to IRAs. We can get into that a little bit. So it's more than just plans. 8424, though, would be an exemption for most insurance products other than individual variable annuities sold to IRAs. And then that's the second piece of guidance. The third piece will be the so-called best interest contract exemption, which is where the, I think, which is the document that most people will turn to first when the final rule comes out, because that's where the rules will either be made workable or not. I don't know if they'll ever become attractive, but if BICE is made workable, then maybe the whole thing would be at least to a degree workable. Okay, that's the overview. Let's start, Brad, with the fiduciary definition. Right now it's a very broad definition that would cause virtually all investment sales practices to plans and IRAs to be considered fiduciary advice. It would invoke the prudent man rule and the formulation of the advice. It would invoke the duty of loyalty, a duty of loyalty to the participants in plans, a duty of loyalty to the IRA owner for IRAs, where generally speaking the rule is that the advisor has to subordinate their interests to the interests of the participants or to the interests of the IRA owner. Where do you think we're going? Where do you think the changes will be on that one, Brad?
Well, one of the questions I'm getting the most when I'm out talking about where we might be, and first of all, let me just say I'm almost eager just to have this, even though I'm apprehensive about what's going to be in the final rule, I can't wait to see it because I'm tired of speculating about what it might be. But I think one of the most important issues I keep hearing about is will there be a grandfather provision, will there be a transition rule that lets us make an orderly change for the tens of millions of IRA accounts out there, either permitting them to continue or permitting them to continue under their current arrangements for a period of time long enough to really make, again, an orderly transition. The grandfather provision that DOL put into the proposal was itself unworkable and was full of problems. It only applied to certain types of assets in the accounts, and it only if you made a hold recommendation, it only applied so long as you didn't give additional advice. And if a hold recommendation is advice, then it's very hard to know when you have or haven't given additional advice. There are all sorts of issues. They need an orderly transition rule here to avoid major costs and problems. And so what's one of the things I'm going to be looking for in the broad rule? How do we get from A to B? How do we deal with old business? I don't think DOL is going to completely exempt old business and just say it's fine, let it continue, but they need to give us a reasonable path forward to getting to the new rule. It can't just be, hey, in 8 months everything changes. So that's one thing. Another is the definition of the education carve-out. Exactly what conduct will be non-fiduciary educational information is going to be vital to how people set up call centers, how they interact with participants, and what DOL has said there. In the proposal, they suggested that if you were giving asset class model allocation charts, that would be education, but if you ever mentioned any specific investments, suddenly it would be advice. And there was a lot of consternation about that in terms of trying to educate plan participants who are going to look at you and say, well, what is a large cap fund and do I have one in my plan? And if you can't answer that, then what's the purpose of suggesting that maybe they should be looking at a certain allocation to large cap funds? We think DOL is going to fix some of that, at least with respect to plans, probably say you can do education and mention investments as long as you mention all of the investments. But that is going to still, I think, be a problem on the IRA side in terms of how can I interact with an IRA owner and discuss what might be right for them without getting into an advice scenario with still being in an education scenario. So that definition and that carve-out in the fiduciary definition is going to be very important. Another one that I'm going to be looking at with interest is how they define the platform provider carve-out, whether they extend that from plan platforms to also IRA platforms, and how they define it so that we know what types of conduct, for example, if my platform offers an elective option to use a third-party investment advisor or investment manager, is that a recommendation of that manager by the platform provider or not? A number of those types of questions that we'll be looking at there.
I think we feel that the DOL will allow the 321 non-discretionary third-party advisor and the 338 discretionary third-party advisor to be considered part of the platform. At least I'm optimistic about that. What do you think, Brad?
I wouldn't be quite as optimistic, but I do think they ought to. It seems to me there's no difference between saying, hey, I culled the universe of investments down to these, 1,000 or 500 that I'm offering as a product to you. It seems to me there's no difference to say that is not fiduciary conduct than it is to say, oh, and by the way, I also have a partnership with a 321 advisor who will pass through this fiduciary advice, which you can choose to buy or not. It's just as you chose to pick me as your platform provider or not with the investments I offer. So I agree with you, they ought to come to that conclusion. I hope they do, and I hope they don't attach a bunch of strings to it, like suggesting you can do it, but not if there's only one option. And if there's only one option, maybe it's a recommendation. So I'm hopeful that they'll fix that, but let's wait and see.
Yeah, I know some providers are already working out deals with two or three different third-party national RIA firms so that they have a platform of advisors as well as a platform of investments on the thinking that it may require more than one. And just so everybody listening understands what we're talking about foundationally, the fiduciary definition says that because a record keeper or a provider of a platform offers a retirement plan platform to the marketplace, that's not considered investment advice. And it appears, regardless of whether it has 100 investments on it or 5,000 investments on it. But the proposal also says that doesn't apply to IRAs, that they're not deciding that there's a carve-out, an automatic carve-out for IRAs, that more or less it says that determining whether or not an IRA platform is a recommendation of the investments on the platform or whether it's just a recommendation of the platform, with the former being investment advice and fiduciary status and the latter not, is a facts and circumstances test. So, you know, we're left to advise clients on that, and there's no bright line. So we can give fairly extreme examples of, like, if it's just 20 proprietary funds, yeah, that might be investment advice. If it's 2,000 funds on the IRA platform or a brokerage account, then that probably isn't investment advice. But there's no real guidance on deciding which facts and circumstances to look at to make the facts and circumstances test. So,
I would go a step farther and say, hey, if I'm offering you a platform, even if it's only 20 proprietary funds, I'm not controlling your decision to buy it. I'm just offering a service
in the
marketplace.
Why the DOL, or what the DOL said about whether or not there's an IRA platform carve-out.
No, I agree. That's what DOL said. I'm just saying the broader issue here is, I think, what DOL is suggesting and what the right legal interpretation is and how long we're going to fight about it and who wants to be a test case for it. These are all going to be issues we're going to have to confront once we see the final rule and figure out how to live with it. But I just want to make the point. I would argue that even if it's a very limited menu, you're not controlling whether they hire you to accept that menu or not. I would argue it shouldn't be fiduciary in any event, but...
Oh, yeah.
Again, we'll
I think that's a good argument. Yeah, I'm just talking about the problem with – so you all know the problem with good arguments versus bad arguments in this area is that when you're advising people as an outside lawyer, if you're wrong, there's hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars at stake. So it becomes a very difficult area for lawyers to advise in, because you can't very well afford to be wrong, and therefore it incents you to look for the safe answer rather than the arguably good answer. Any other changes you see, Brad, to the fiduciary definition that might be interesting to people?
Yeah, I think there's two others I'd focus on. One is how DOL handles the criticism it got for the large plan carve-out from advice. In other words, with some minimal disclosure, if it's a plan with $100 million in assets or 100 participants or more, I can still give them sales information without being a fiduciary. And that's not available to plans or individuals under the proposal. How DOL modifies that, if at all, is going to be interesting to see and potentially be quite significant in terms of what compliance opportunities and paths for compensation are available under the final rule. The other is how they ultimately define a recommendation and what conduct constitutes establishing this fiduciary relationship. You know, one of the issues people keep talking about is, well, is the definition of recommendation going to be the same under this as it is under securities law and sort of the FINRA, compilation of FINRA guidance? Will DOL clarify that or not? Those are issues people are also going to be looking for.
Yeah, moving on to the 8424 exemption, two big issues that people talk about there, Brad, are, the individual variable annuities aren't included. They're taken out of the insurance exemption, 8424, and moved over to the securities exemption, the best interest contract exemption. That's one issue. Will they come back? The other issue I hear a lot of people talking about, well, gee, the individual variable annuities are, when sold to IRAs, look very much like individual fixed indexed annuities, which are still under 8424. Are they going to be moved over to the best interest contract exemption? And I haven't seen, other than industry conversation, I haven't seen anything coming out of the DOL that suggests that they're going to treat individual variable annuities any differently than they did in the proposal, or that they're going to treat fixed indexed annuities any different than they did in the proposal. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, you know, the rationale DOL used in separating individual variable annuities from 8424 was that, well, these are securitized, and so annuities that are securities should be treated differently than annuities that aren't, and of course, fixed index annuities are not considered securities. I don't think, as much as DOL might have some issues there, I don't see them trying to come up with a new rationale for that. I kind of think they'll stick with the division they came up with for good or ill, because I think it's just going to be easier for them to continue to justify that basis for a distinction rather than create a new one and incur a whole bunch more questions on an issue that really hasn't been fully developed in comments, and therefore with an eye towards litigation, they probably don't want to rock the boat on things that they don't view as crucial. So my guess is we'll see fixed index annuities stay in 8424. I think otherwise in 8424, the big issues are more or less the same as they have been since we've been looking at this, which is how will they define commissions, what effect is that going to have on industry compensation practices, and what about advice after the sale? Is it covered or not by the exemption that's provided? In other words, the exemption clearly covers the commissions associated with, you know, putting in that annuity, but what about advice given in an annuity down the road to the, is that covered by the exemption or not? And I think different people are reading it different ways, but I suspect DOL will be clear on that based on the comments they've received.
Well, good. Well, let's move to the big one. What about the best interest contract exemption? What do you see happening there?
Well, this is, of course, as you said at the top of the program, this is really one of the biggest questions out there, and so this is where I'll make, well, you know, it's ERISA, so the jokes aren't funny, but, you know, to BIC or not to BIC, that is the question. Again, that's as funny as it gets, and I apologize, but that really is the issue. I mean, when we're looking at clients and talking to other folks about what are they thinking with compliance, there are some who are at the outset saying, we figure we can figure out a way to avoid using the BIC, we think. There's others, and this is probably where most folks are, is, well, it ultimately depends on what's in the BIC. We need to see what we're dealing with to really come up with a conclusion. And the issues there, as you were saying earlier, really go to a lot of the questions of will this be, you know, the word people keep using is workable. So you've got the disclosure question as one, which is you have to make under the proposal, a series of very detailed disclosures by dollar amount. There were questions about how these disclosure projections might conflict with some obligations under securities laws, about not projecting the future performance of investments. Lots of concern about how would you gather the data and what systems would you have to build and how long and would it take and how much would it cost. I suspect DOL is going to modify the disclosure provisions at least for a temporary period of time to make them something that people could potentially comply with before, you know, by the effective date of this regulation, let's assume by the end of the year. Because otherwise they're going to get an exemption that just still doesn't work. So I think we're going to see changes in the disclosures. I think it's likely, I mean, again, this is speculation, but I think it's likely the DOL will allow this contract to be unilateral. In other words, that the service provider, the financial advisor, the financial institution will be able to hold out a contract as this is what we will adhere to without having to go get wet signatures from every participant or every IRA owner on that contract, say, as you were saying, at sort of an early part in their conversations, and that this would probably be retroactive. In other words, we might start a conversation, we might talk about what you might want to do on a rollover or whatever, but we wouldn't actually have to sign this contract until we decide to do a transaction, and then it would apply retroactively to our previous discussions. That kind of an administrability issue, I think, is something DOL will probably address. Some issues I don't think they're going to address as well as we would hope. The definition of assets, the BIC exemption, is only available for assets that are listed on DOL's list of what we'll call the good asset list, and it doesn't include things on the other list, which would be hedge funds, calls, puts, options, various types of non-publicly traded investments or not terribly liquid investments. DOL, I think, is going to continue to adhere to the idea that if the BIC exemption is providing some loosening of the requirements of complete impartiality, then it can only apply to investments that they think don't lend themselves to abuse. And I think at the end of the day, that's what they think they're doing. with this asset limitation. I think the asset limitation is a bad idea, period, but I think DealWell is going to retain it, even though they might tweak which assets are on the list.
Yeah, I think so too, Brad. And I just so people understand, if something isn't in the definition of assets in the best interest contract exemption, then you can't use the exemption. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means they can still be in an investor's portfolio, but only if the advisor is a pure level fee advisor, meaning neither the advisor nor its supervisor entity nor any affiliate can receive any additional compensation relative to that particular investment. So it doesn't mean people can't have the investment. It just means that the advisor has to work in a purely conflict-free environment, which is difficult because these investments historically have compensated advisors out of the investment at levels that differ because maybe it takes more information and more time to explain a hedge fund than a mutual fund. In any event, it's a very controversial provision, and my reading of the tea leaves is the same as Brad's.
Yeah,
you want to add something else on BIC, or should we move on?
Well, the last big piece for the BIC exemption is how the exemption is written to address individual variable annuities. There is, of course, the industry requested that DOL put individual variable annuities back in 8424, but the industry also put in a number of comments saying, if you won't do that, we need to see a lot of amendments to the text of the BIC exemption to actually fit with what insurance products are and how they work. Things like the definition of reasonable compensation can't be limited just to services, but also needs to include product features and so forth. And so there was a fairly extensive list of changes the insurance industry sort of writ large put in saying, hey, if you're going to keep this in BIC, look at these types of changes to put annuities on more of a level playing field within the BIC compared to other investments. So how this is modified, if at all, to accommodate some of those concerns about insurance products, I think is going to be a big question, because if individual variable annuities are effectively only being sold through either pure level fee or the BIC exemption, how the BIC exemption works is going to be crucial for that segment of the industry.
Good. Well, let's talk a little bit, rather than talking about each piece of guidance, let's talk about the impact. And before we get down into the weeds, let's talk about the impact in terms of three categories: impact on advice to plans, impact on advice to IRAs, impact on advice about distributions and rollovers, but not in great detail, just big picture impact. And let me start off with impact on plans. I'm seeing, once plans get to much of any size, they generally tend to, from the advisor's perspective, to be pure level fee, either pure level fee paid out of an expense recapture account, pure level fee paid out of the plan assets and allocated to the participants, but nonetheless pure level fee. And if anybody doesn't know what an expense recapture account is, that's where the record keeper collects all the 12b1 fees and the subtransfer agency fees and other payments from the mutual funds, and then effectively puts them into a bucket, a bucket held on the books of the record keeper or a bucket in the plan, and then they pay expenses out of there, including their own record keeping expense. So for plans, which at least for larger, say 10 million and up plans, maybe even 5 million and up, I think most of them are already either in compliance or very close to compliance. As you get down to smaller plans, if they're group annuity contracts, the compensation of the advisor is already spread evenly over all the assets in the plan. So with a few tweaks, they can be in compliance as well, because the advice among the mutual funds in the plan doesn't affect the advisor's level of compensation. And then what we're seeing in other cases where the broker-dealer might be concerned about the fiduciary status and the expertise of the advisors in a retirement plan context, I think they're going to be demanding that the providers have a 321 or a 321 non-discretionary investment advisor on the platform, or multiple if required, or a 338 discretionary investment advisor on the platform, so that the advisors can recommend the advisor to the individual company, and its plan can recommend the platform and can recommend the 321 or the 338, which would be a fiduciary act in its own right, but a more limited fiduciary act than recommending investments, so that the advice can be, so there will be some fiduciary status, but pretty limited fiduciary status, and most of the third-party RIAs on the platform are big brand names, so the odds of making an imprudent recommendation are pretty limited. So I could see where that the compensation would have to be level, but from the advisor's perspective, I can see where that could happen, maybe in a less disruptive way than a lot of people are thinking. Still disruptive, but maybe less disruptive than people are thinking. But not so much less disruptive if there are proprietary products like proprietary mutual funds on the platform. Then that creates a whole separate set of issues on the best interest contract exemption would be needed. Do you see it the same way, Brad? I mean, just for limited to plans for the moment, is that sort of what you're hearing from people?
I think that's generally true. I mean, I think people are also still sort of hedging their bets to wait and see, of course, what's in the final rule to figure out which options might work. But I think in general, it's safe to say that the transition here for plans is going to be easier than it is on the IRA side. But really, probably the hardest part of the market are the small plans and dealing with some of those issues.
Yeah, I agree. And then moving on to IRAs, it's going to be extraordinarily disruptive. Let me just explain briefly. Most broker-dealers have five different product lines that they can offer to IRAs. It could be individual fixed annuities or fixed index annuities, just think regular insurance annuities of one kind or another. That can be sold under 8424. There could be individual variable annuities offered to IRAs, which would have to be sold under the best interest contract exemption. And as Brad has so well pointed out, we just don't know if it's going to be workable or not. It could be a portfolio of mutual funds with asset allocation, which would also either would have to be pure level fee or sold under the best interest contract exemption. It could be referrals to third-party discretionary investment managers, same thing. Excuse me. Or it could be individual brokerage accounts, which is, in my mind, the hardest one to figure out of all, because in an individual account there could be a lot of activity in 1 year resulting in commissions, and then there could be 2 or 3 years with no activity. To me, it's a bit of an enigma as to how you apply a level fee to that that is appropriate for the amount of effort that particular account takes. So, but there are those five different scenarios, and each one of them has to be dealt with under these exemptions if the compensation is variable or if proprietary products are involved. And overlay on that, Brad, I want to talk to you about is even on top of that, I'm talking about inside each of the five lines of business, but on top of that, the advisor has to help the investor figure out which one of those five options is the better choice, or at least a prudent choice for the investor. How do they do that? Education is an obvious answer, but I think we all know at the end of the education, the investor will turn to the advisor, the financial advisor, and say, gee, I really appreciate the education. What should I do? How far do you think the advisor can go before they become a fiduciary? And do you think the rule changes might help some?
They may help. I'm not terribly optimistic because, the fundamental sort of policy dispute here is what is conflict and does conflict actually result in negative outcomes for participants? And DOL is defining conflict incredibly broadly in the way that ERISA has always defined conflict, which is a hyper-protective other people's money statute based on the notion that anyone close to a plan is going to steal from it, which is a difficult way to get it to approach balancing interests. So, as I've said in testimony before the department and other places, this isn't a best interest standard. This is really a solely in the interest standard, and there's a world of difference between those two and how you behave. This is exactly where that line comes down, and this is where the rub is. How close can I go to helping somebody without, no matter how good my advice is, still being subject to a prohibited transaction? Now, if you look at it and say, well, this really is analogous to providing asset class-based recommendations, where I've talked to you about a product, but I haven't about a class of products, but I haven't recommended a specific product. That seems to me a line that we should be able to say it's not advice if you're still talking about, you know, types of products rather than specific products. But it becomes more and more difficult the fewer choices there are left in that discussion. So, you know, what you were just saying, where there's five choices to be made, it becomes much harder to avoid providing advice under those circumstances.
Yeah, I struggle with that. I think we all know that the safe answer is just education, but I think we also know that the difficulty is that, as I said earlier, some investors are going to say, so what should I do? And the system can't very well leave them adrift.
Well, let me jump in and say, unfortunately, I think the reality is the system does leave them adrift even currently. I mean, this is a problem that I hear from advisors all the time who are doing education meetings and say, so how do I answer these participants who look at me and say, but really, what do I do? And even if I'm giving them good advice, I still can't do it. That's just, to me, a fundamental – that to me, that indicates that we're doing the system wrong. But let me get back off my soapbox, because it doesn't matter what I think, because we have to deal with what we're going to get. And what we're going to get is going to continue to say no advice is better than so-called conflicted advice.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's a combination – it's a parade of horrors in the sense that you know, the way the statute was written in 1974 and signed by President Ford on Labor Day of 1974, it creates this absolute prohibited transaction regime for financial conflicts of interest. And then the Department of Labor is given the authority to grant exemptions from those rules. But the prohibitions themselves are not the Department of Labor. The prohibitions are in the statute. The broadening of the definition of advice is the Department of Labor, and the drafting and the conditions of the exemptions is the Department of Labor, but the prohibitions are the statute. Well, Brad, let's talk very quickly about distributions and rollovers, and we'll go into a little more detail in a minute. In 2005, the Department of Labor said that you're a fiduciary advisor to the plan, and you make a recommendation, somebody take a distribution or roll over with you, that's a fiduciary act, then it could be a prohibited transaction. So in the retirement plan world, for an advisor who's already a fiduciary to the plan, we've had to deal with this since 2005. But this proposal says if anybody, regardless of whether they have a pre-existing relationship with a plan or with an IRA owner, makes a recommendation for a distribution out of a plan or out of an IRA, that is a fiduciary act, and if the person's going to make money off of it, more money, you know, and if they're going to increase their compensation or otherwise commit a prohibited transaction, then they have to, not only does the recommendation have to be a prudent recommendation, but it also has to, they also have to satisfy the prohibited transaction rules. And we didn't really address this when we talked earlier about the fiduciary definition, but my sense is that the DOL is pretty much going to hold the line on that rule, that any recommendation about a distribution or a rollover from a plan or an IRA would be a fiduciary act. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I mean, one of the big issues that's motivating this entire regulation is the fact that ERISA money ends up in IRAs, and IRAs are now bigger than ERISAs. I mean, so they view it as all this wonderful world of bubble wrapping of participants, to use your phrase, which I love, is you know, being changed in one bit of advice provided once in a rollover, and that's really what's the impetus behind a lot of what's going on with this regulation. So I don't see DOL backing off of saying rollover or other distribution advice is fiduciary advice. The question I have is, so what are the consequences of that? If it's fiduciary advice, we now have to get into the process by which I make the recommendation, but how do the prohibited transaction rules apply to that? So you mentioned the guidance from 2003. The guidance from 2003 created a questionable gray area. On the one hand, it was helpful saying if you're not a fiduciary, then it's not fiduciary advice to do a rollover. They're affirmatively changing that with this rule. On the other hand, it was unhelpful because it said if you already have a relationship as a fiduciary to this plan, it's fiduciary advice, but it may be a prohibited transaction. They didn't say whether it was or wasn't. And we have that same concern here, which is if I'm giving fiduciary advice by talking to you about the advisability of a rollover, making a recommendation about the advisability of a rollover, when do I need an exemption to do that, or when can I just do it based on whatever services we agree to? And it seems like if I'm already a fiduciary to the plan, or my affiliate's a fiduciary to the plan, then probably I do need to worry about a prohibited transaction, because by telling you to do the rollover, I may be causing myself or my affiliates to be paid more than they were making before. The question is, where I don't have a relationship and my affiliates don't have a relationship with this plan or with this participant, is it a prohibited transaction then? And that's an area that I would really like to see more clarification from the Department of Labor on in this final rule.
Yeah. I think most people would probably say the amount involved, which is just another way of saying the prohibited transaction, is any compensation received by the advisor, the supervisory entity, or any affiliate. So you're right, it's not clear. I mean, nowhere does it actually say that. That's just an extension. Well, let me, I want to add a little more to how broker-dealers are adapting to this. And we've already talked about plans and about what's going to need to be done there. But it's interesting to me that the way broker-dealers are adapting depends on a variety of factors. There's no one-size-fits-all answer. One is just the culture of the broker-dealer itself. Did they have a strong home office that can decide proactively which products and services will be distributed and how they'll be done? Or are the advisors very independent and, let's say, independent contractors, and the culture is that our advisors can pretty well sell any insurance products or any mutual fund products that they want? We have hundreds of selling agreements. So that kind of a culture. Another one is our 90% of our advisors are already registered as investment advisor representatives. Therefore, that broker-dealer would be more inclined to allow their advisors to serve as an IIR and be subject to the fiduciary rule under the securities law. You know, one of the interesting things about this rule is that if you're giving advice to an IRA for a fee under the securities laws, and if you don't have any proprietary products, then you don't need the 84-24 exemption. You don't need the best interest contract exemption because there's no prohibited transaction. Therefore, you don't need an exemption. Therefore, you don't need to agree to be bound by the best interest standard of care, and you're not a fiduciary under ERISA. So that pure level fee scenario for IRAs is one way where you could have just hung up when I said hello at the beginning of the call, because none of this is going to apply to you. Now, my experience is some RIAs don't quite understand what a pure level fee is. We're seeing RIAs getting 12b1 fees, using proprietary mutual funds, collective trusts, getting computers or services or payments or subsidies from providers, from service providers, from investment providers, and so on. So I don't want to leave the impression that I'm saying every RIA out there doesn't have to worry about this, because we're seeing that many RIAs don't quite understand these rules either. What ERISA says is money or things of monetary value. It doesn't talk about transfer agent fees, management fees, all this other stuff. So that's it. I'm done. I'll get off my high horse now on RIAs. But keep in mind that there is that one scenario under which none of this is needed. And that's if you're providing pure level fee advice, such that the advisor, the supervisor entity, and all affiliates do not receive anything more than their stated fee, then you don't need any of this. Okay. So that's one scenario some broker-dealers are looking at, but they can only afford to look at that if most of their advisors are already registered as IARs. They have to look at more of a product-type solution if they're just registered representatives or so-called financial advisors. 84-24, by and large, I think, for annuity sales and insurance sales, 84-24 seems pretty workable to most advisors. Now, We're seeing some of the insurance companies that manufacture the insurance product want to be able to make additional payments. Additional payments if proprietary funds are sold or proprietary products are sold. Additional payments for people to sell a bigger volume of this or a lesser volume of that, or just additional payments, whether you call it revenue sharing, whether you call it the chairman's club or the platinum level or whatever you want to call it, it's additional payments. 8424 is limited to commissions, period, commissions. We think it'll be expanded for career agents to include retirement plan credits and health credits. But personally, I don't think it's going to be expanded to include anything beyond that. So I don't think it'll cover bonuses, trips, awards, recognitions, you name it. But beyond that, generally speaking, 8424 looks like it's going to work in the annuity context for most of the broker-dealers I'm talking to. The difficulty comes in with the best interest contract exemption, where if the broker dealer has a lot of the people registered as IRs, and if they're willing to go to a level fee scenario, they're really going to go that way, because they're apprehensive about the best interest contract exemption, the expense of it, the difficulty of it, and the class action provision in it, which says that class actions can be filed based on, you know, class-wide violations of the representations in the contract or compliance with the exemption. So it's somewhat problematic for them. It's very problematic for them. Now, but if you have proprietary products, there's really almost no way around it. I'll leave out a few minor ways because they don't apply broadly enough, but from a broad-based perspective, people who have proprietary products are going to need the best interest contract exemption, and that group really is waiting. They're thinking, they're planning, but they're waiting to see what the best interest contract exemption says. So, Brad, that's sort of my overview of the broker-dealer scenario. Let me just move on to rollovers, and then we can open it up to questions, and that way we'll, after I'm done with this, and that will preserve a little time at the end, and maybe you could throw in a few more thoughts then. But in terms of the rollovers, there's two groups that have to comply with the rollover rules primarily. There's individual advisors who would recommend rollovers to participants or IRA owners, and there's the call centers of the record keepers. By and large, at this point in time, the call centers of the record keepers are going to a pure educational model. That pure educational model is more or less outlined in FINRA Regulatory Notice 13-45. Shortly after the end of, in early 2014, FINRA also issued an investor alert on distributions and rollovers that are somewhat helpful for understanding what investment or what distribution education means. So, and some broker-dealers are mandating that their advisors, for the time being at least, just give distribution education, and not recommend a distribution and rollover. Then the investor makes the decision, the money rolls over to the IRA, then the advisor can be either a securities law fiduciary or an ERISA-type fiduciary for recommending the investments inside the IRA. Long haul, most people don't think that's a workable solution because, as Brad and I have said along the way today, we're worried that the advisors or the customers, investors, are going to say to the advisors, what should I do? And then the advisors put in the position of needing to make a recommendation. The hope is that the best interest contract exemption will become more workable. For example, if you're not getting anything out of the plan, you'd say, I don't make any money on the plan. I'll charge 100 basis points a year to advise on your IRA. You know, therefore, there will be that additional expense. Now, I'm giving you a very simplistic example, but if it could be that simple and it didn't have to get into all of the investments and what the expense ratios are, and, you know, for investments you haven't even recommended yet, then maybe it could be workable. Having said that, I just also wanted to point out that, I mean, what we're doing for people going to education scenarios, we're creating education brochures. We're also creating talking points. And we're creating provisions that go in the advisory agreement or in the account opening agreement that says where the customer says, the advisor did not make a recommendation. I received investment education or distribution education. Based on that education, I made a decision to roll over. So we're creating a lot of documentation in support of that approach, which is the one that many people are taking now. Also, I want to point out that the SEC is investigating as a part of its examination program. Both the SEC and FINRA are looking at advisors' practices. For example, in a recent examination by the SEC of an RIA, and we've received these for broker-dealers as well, they say, the SEC says, provide any written disclosures and any scripts used during the past 6 months regarding distribution options, conflicts of interest, the various types of account options available, and the various types of investment options available to customers. So they're trying to find, they're trying to get more deeply into what are broker-dealers and RIAs saying to investors about distributions and rollovers. Brad, that's it. Back to you for opening up the questions.
Well, yeah. So, operator, if you can go ahead and tell folks how to ask questions, then I'll make one last thought while they're queuing up.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, simply press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone. If on a speakerphone, disengage your mute function so your signal will reach our equipment. Again, star 1, and we'll pause a moment to assemble the roster.
Yeah, so while folks are lining up for the questions, the one thing I didn't mention on the BIC exemption, which of course I should have and you all were probably thinking about, is the enforcement mechanism that DOL chose in the proposal is basically class action litigation in state courts for breaches of contract. Unfortunately, I suspect DOL is going to continue to follow that type of approach because they don't have the authority to directly enforce prohibited transaction issues for IRAs otherwise. That authority is with the IRS. And I think DOL views that as really the only way they can get their point across. Now, I think DOL is going to rue the day if that, in fact, is what the final rule looks like by inviting county courts across the country to start interpreting ERISA provisions with a gloss of contract law and getting wildly different interpretations of what DOL thought were long-established legal principles. But unfortunately, that, I think, is where they're going to continue to go. And that's one of the big factors people have to take into account in analyzing whether, you know, into BIC or not to BIC, is what's the legal risk and cost associated with doing so. Do we have any questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone, a voice prompt will indicate that your line has been opened. We ask that you please state your name before posing your question. We'll take our first caller.
Hello.
John Blossom calling. My question is that assuming that we're looking at a rollout or rollover from a plan, Does the only issue that appears to be counting or countable is the compensation that goes to the advisor? I guess I'm really looking for let's assume that there's a 50 basis points administrative cost being in the plan and a 50 basis points advisor fee. Can the rollover have a 100 basis points fee, or do you think it's going to be limited to the 50?
But now you raise a great point, and the question is, how would we figure out whether there's a prohibited transaction in these rollover scenarios or not? How do you figure out what a level fee is? And really, you're going to have, under this new conception, two questions to ask on any rollover, and they're going to account for fees differently. The first question is this a prudent recommendation for this participant? So that's where I'm going to look at what are the all-in costs for the participant to go from the plan to the IRA? What's the difference in overall pricing? What are the differences in services? What are the difference in investments, and taking into account all of those factors, is this a prudent thing for that person to do? That's one aspect of the fees. Then on the prohibited transaction side, that's where you look at compensation to the advisor and its affiliates. Is the even if this is actually cheaper for the participant on net, and even if this is actually advice no one would question, if I, the advisor, and my affiliates and or my affiliates are going to make more money than we would have in the plan, that may well be a prohibited transaction for which we need an exemption like the BIC exemption. So you're going to have to look at it both ways. One, what's best for the participant, and two, what's even possible for the advisor under the payment structure. Fred, any thoughts on that?
No, I think that's exactly right, and I've gotten that question a number of times because people tend to put the privative the fiduciary definition together with the exemptions, and you really need to separate them as Brad just did in order to do the proper analysis. Costs can be a factor for prudence, but only compensation is a factor for the prohibited transaction exemptions.
Or another way to put that, which I favor to remind DOL why this approach is wrong, is that prudent advice can still be prohibited.
We'll take our next question.
Lori Moss, will the Dominion's distribution have a problem for plan sponsors to initiate for terminating employees with the proposed new ruling?
So you're suggesting where they have account balances of less than 1,000 or 5,000, can we still follow the same rules that we've been using there?
Yes, will there be any prohibited transactions because for them to not allow them to initiate Dominion's distributions?
I mean, based on the proposal, I think that those rules are going to operate essentially the same way. Fred, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree. I mean, the plan sponsor is making a decision to force those distributions. It's not the advisor. I guess we could create a really wild situation where the advisor recommends to the plan sponsor that the plan sponsor do it, and then somehow the money market account and those little IRAs pays a fee or commission to the advisor. But I think it'd have to be a really strange fact situation for that to be. It's basically an employer-driven decision, and the employer doesn't get anything out of it, directly. So I don't think so. The area where I see more worry about that is, some advisory firms, some broker-dealers have agreements with record keepers that the record keeper will notify them if any participant is leaving. This isn't a small account. This is usually a bigger account. And then we'll refer that account to the advisor, that departing participant to the advisor to capture the rollover. And I worry about that because a recommendation or a referral to a fiduciary is a fiduciary act under the new rules. And so our record keepers can be comfortable referring fiduciaries in that sense. So there's an analogous situation I actually worry about a little bit more.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, *1 if you would like to ask a question, and we'll take our next caller.
Hi, this is Chin Kim. Hey, Fred. Hey, Brad. Question
on
the level fee process as a fiduciary. I guess structurally it sounds good. Some products you can, it doesn't pay any type of compensation. So I guess an advisor charging a level fee would work. But, when they broaden the scope of other product offerings, not all products are commission-free. So how would an advisor really manage that process when there's going to be differential comp just because that's how products are designed in today's marketplace?
Yeah, this is one of the thorniest problems, particularly on the broker-dealer side, is trying to figure out how do I get to some sort of levelized compensation structure in connection with different products, for example, an annuity versus an index fund or something, where you might have just radically different compensation structures. And that's going to, as Fred alluded to earlier, I think the response is going to be quite different depending on where it is you want to try and achieve the levelization. Are some broker-dealers going to say, okay, we're offering these types of products on our platform. This is what our advisors are able to advise about. And if you want to be on this platform, you're going to pay us at the product level this amount of compensation. Whether we call it commissions or whatever, at the product level for our platform, it's going to be uniform. Alternatively, you might be in a situation where at the advisor level, you're offsetting and otherwise adjusting so that different products continue to pay different commissions or different 12B1 fees or whatever it is, but you're on your end figuring out how to make it uniform and deal with the potential prohibited transaction issues there. Alternatively, we may see the BIC exemption being a way to resolve that, where it may permit different compensation structures. For example, an individual variable annuity might be able to pay a different way without having a prohibited transaction than some other advice model. Part of that's going to depend on your situation. Part of it's going to depend, frankly, on the letter of the law in these final rules, so we can figure out what the right path is forward. But I think the reality is the right path forward is going to be very individualized for different types of providers who have different different types of product concentrations. Fred, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're running into a lot of different scenarios like that. For example, if the issue on levelizing the advisor's compensation is that a fund, that an unrelated third-party fund pays a 12b1 fee, then a couple broker-dealers we're working with have the software and the processes in place where they can offset the 12b1 fee against the advisor's compensation. That's sometimes called, against the total compensation, the advisory fee. That's sometimes called the offset method. I'm working with one right now that is using what I call the payover method, where when they get the 12b1 fee, they pay that dollar amount over into the IRA rather than offsetting it against their fee. But either way, their fee is levelized. Then depending on the circumstances, there are a host of exemptions out there. There's a couple exemptions under the Pension Protection Act for non-discretionary investment advice to participants in IRAs. There's the SunAmerica advisory opinion for both discretionary and non-discretionary investment advice to plan participants or IRA owners. And there's the old prohibited transaction exemption 77-4 for use of proprietary mutual funds, as well as a couple advisory opinions. I'm really picking up on what Brad said, that it's somewhat customized depending on the organization that we're working with, depending on the nature of the offset. But believe me, everybody's an overstatement. Lots and lots of people are looking at this issue of levelization, and that it just depends on a whole host of issues. For example, do they have the capacity to do these offsets or payovers? Are we talking about 12b1 fees, or are we talking about proprietary investments? We're doing a lot of work on that.
We'll take our next caller.
Hey, this is Jill with HD Vest. Jill Hudler with HD Vest. For the analysis on the, if you're not the fiduciary on the existing plan and you're helping the participants move on the rollover decision, how do they propose figuring out what the fees are for the participant on the existing plan? Is it going to be relying on 404A5 and some or a different type of disclosure?
That's actually a really good question. If I'm not involved with the plan, so I don't actually know how it's really structured, how do I as an advisor help the participant understand what fees they are paying and what investments and so forth? In other words, how their current plan works to construct a prudent recommendation regarding a rollover. And I agree with you. You're going to have to look at the information you can get. I mean, I think in practice, this isn't the kind of thing where you're going to have to demand certain documents, and if you don't get them, you can't advise. I think it's going to be based on the 404A5 disclosure, based on the information that I can readily get from the plan, here's generally what seems to be going on, and base your recommendation on that. But that is an interesting question, and that highlights what I think is going to be a reality going forward, which is because DOL is changing such a fundamental issue, it's going to have all of these new ramifications and effects on a bunch of activity that we've all come to a common understanding about, which now has to be revised in a new understanding with new questions. So one there is, what's the scope of my obligation to dig into the existing plan to get the information, and is there a point at which I have to say I can't give you advice because I don't know, or I'm giving you the best advice I can based on the limited information? What's the right answer to that question? Those are the kind of issues that we're going to see, I think, as second, third, and fourth degree questions after we've solved the first degree question of how can you even get paid?
Yeah.
Thank you.
When FINRA issued Regulatory Notice 1345, they said if you make a recommendation, if a broker-dealer's representative makes a recommendation to a participant in the plan to take a distribution, that's subject to the suitability standard. And then they more or less said you ought to be looking at things like expenses and services and a host of other issues. I think they had seven non-exclusive factors that they listed in 1345. Or alternatively, you can provide education, then you don't have to look at all of that because you're providing unbiased, good, quality education about the distribution alternatives and what the factors are that a reasonable person would be looking at in making that decision. That's an example of some of the materials that we've created for people. Well, when the DOL issued the proposed regulation, they more or less picked up on that FINRA thinking, and they said you can provide, if you provide a recommendation, it has to be prudent, or if you provide education, you can just point out to the investor what the investor should be looking at or the participant should be looking at rather than what the advisor has to go look at. But if you do make a recommendation, then and it has to be prudent, then yeah, I think, I mean, in advising clients on that, I've said, you know, the best place, the easiest place to get information is from the investment comparative chart that has to be given to participants initially and annually under the 404(a)(5) regulation. That's, to me, that would be where I would look.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, star one, and we'll take our next caller.
And this will be the last question, operator.
Hi, this is Sharon Friedman, and I'd like to go back to the force-out distributions, the 1,000 and 5,000. If you have an institution where the record keeper is determining who gets paid out, sending out the 30-day notices, and then paying the people out to a subsidiary company, all without the plan sponsor okaying, because that's how the plan sponsor wants it set up. They don't want to deal with it at all. Would that then fall into the fiduciary?
Would you mind running that by me again? I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Scenario. My sense is that if you go behind the question, what the plan sponsors directed the record keeper to automatically distribute any accounts under, say, $5,000 if the participants leave and then don't respond to a request that they take a distribution.
Yeah, the plan sponsor does. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it seems to me if the plan sponsor directs it, then the record keeper is just providing a ministerial service. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, and I guess my question is, since the record keeper isn't saying, okay, yes, it's okay to send these things out to, we agree these people are terminated, go ahead and do it, that there's no fee disclosure or fiduciary responsibility in there?
I guess, like I said before, I think in these scenarios, the rules probably don't change, even under the new DOL regulation. This is a question where you're following the direction of the plan. There are established exemptions and a regulation that govern how you deal with these small accounts and mandatory distributions and so forth. So I suspect that if you continue doing things as you are now, assuming you're in compliance currently, that probably wouldn't change in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, Bill, it's back to you to provide the last information here.
Great. Thank you, Fred, and thank you, Brad. Very thorough information, as always, and, of course, timely as we await this decision. And on that note, I'd like to invite everybody to mark their calendars for our next quarterly call, which will take place on Thursday, June 16th. And once again, this call has been recorded, and you will get an email shortly if you'd like to listen to a replay. And, Debbie, with that, we'll close the call. Thank you to everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for your participation today. This does conclude today's conference. Have a great rest of your day.